What happens if nurses intervene in decision-making in the intensive care unit?
Using procalcitonin to guide antibiotic use in people with pneumonia.
What do we know about the state of bacterial and fungal resistance worldwide?
And using alternatives to the car to improve cardiovascular mortality.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on June 1st, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And traveling in France while this is being posted. So safe cycling, Rick.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. I'll be thinking of you while I'm cycling and enjoying good food and wine in France.
And I'll be envious. Speaking of all of that, then, I'm going to let you start. Isn't that unusual? From the journal Heart, Alternatives to the Car and How They Could Impact on Cardiovascular Health.
And this study showed that using alternatives to the car improved cardiovascular disease and mortality in people that were using alternatives to commute to work and even for non-commuting purposes. And they did this by looking at almost 360,000 participants from a United Kingdom biobank. These are people aged 37 to 73. About half of them said that they drove their car to work, and the other half said they commute. It's usually walking or cycling, or could be taking the bus. And what they discovered that the regular commuters that had the more active patterns of travel had a lower incidence of cardiovascular disease by about 11% and a lower risk of fatal cardiovascular disease by about 30%. And those people that use more active transportation for commuting and non-commuting purposes had the lowest cardiovascular risk.
I thought what was interesting was their attempt to correct for confounders in this study also.
Elizabeth, I'm glad you brought that up, because anytime you do these studies where you're trying to see if a particular action or a dietary change improves outcome, you have to either match the groups that are identical in every other way or try to account for other confounding things, gender and lifestyle and diet. These were effects after they had adjusted for all the other confounding variables.
Very positive note. I like that one. Let's turn from here to one of mine. This is one that's, of course, near and dear to my heart because my other role at Johns Hopkins is I'm a chaplain. This is a study that took a look at nurse-led interventions in the ICU for helping people who are called surrogate decision makers, those who are making decisions for a patient who is unable to make decisions on their own. And this is a whole support kind of a study. The acronym for this study was PARTNER. And this involved nurses who had quite a bit of training coming in and helping the surrogate decision makers to understand everything that was going on with the patient so that they were able to make better decisions. And the question was, did this help? Did this help with long-term experiences on the part of survivors with regard to depression and anxiety? And in that particular outcome measure, the intervention really wasn't terribly helpful. They took a look at just over 1,400 patients in five ICUs over this study, and everybody got enrolled in this particular intervention. The one thing that they showed that I actually thought was really very meaningful was that the length of stay in the ICU was shorter in the group that received the intervention than it was with usual care. What that means to me is that basically surrogate decision makers understood that there was futility involved with these interventions and chose not to intervene any longer so that death came a little bit sooner among those folks. And frankly, again, from my seat in the bleachers, that is a profound reduction in suffering, and I applaud that outcome.
About one in five individuals that are admitted to ICU will experience death. Informing families, surrogate decision makers, about the outcome of individuals can help them make decisions based upon what the wishes or needs of the patient were. I was surprised by the fact that using this intensive nurse-led effort didn't actually decrease anxiety or depression, but as you mentioned, it did reduce hospital stay. It did increase in-hospital mortality, but it did not change six-month mortality. As you noted, that suggests that we're helping people make decisions when additional care actually is futile. So there is some benefit to it, but it isn't the benefit that we suspected.
I'm not sure about that outcome of anxiety and depression in people who survive this kind of an experience. I'm not sure that there's much we can do to reduce that.
what the nurse-led discussion did was it did make the decision-making easier, but it didn't change anxiety or depression. So those two are probably not linked.
As I suggested, I think maybe some anxiety and depression following the death of someone you really love is probably to be expected.
Regardless of whether you had a better informed decision or not, I think you're right, Elizabeth.
Let's transition then from here to the next one. And that's a look in the New England Journal of Medicine at whether the, shall we call it, metabolite, procalcitonin, is helpful in antibiotic prescribing.
It showed that a procalcitonin-guided use of antibiotics for lower respiratory tract infections did not decrease antibiotic use. So let's take a step back for a second. When people present with symptoms consistent with a lower respiratory tract infection, it could be due to a viral infection, it could be due to a bacterial infection, it's exacerbation of bronchitis or asthma or COPD. What a blood test called procalcitonin can help us determine is it's elevated in individuals that have bacterial pneumonia and not in the other conditions that I mentioned. So people have used this blood test to help decrease antibiotic use. They assessed it here in the United States in 14 hospitals, 1,600 different patients, half of whom had a procalcitonin measured and the physician had access to it. The other half, it was measured, but the physicians didn't have access to it. Does that information decrease unnecessary antibiotic use? And in this particular study, it didn't. Because we're now better antibiotic stewards, we don't give them out as frequently as we did before. Even in those that didn't have the procalcitonin measured, antibiotic use was restricted to individuals that had clinical symptoms that indicated they might have a bacterial infection. The second thing is, even when physicians had the procalcitonin, there were times where they said, I know it's low and I wouldn't normally give antibiotics, but I just don't feel comfortable. It looks like a bacterial infection. So they, in fact, did use antibiotics. This throws some light on the fact that if you have proper antibiotic steward, then maybe this particular blood test may not provide additional incremental beneficial information.
Okay, well, that was a really lovely positive message. The negative one, I guess, or the question that remains is, gosh, what about those folks who prescribe them anyway?
It's a behavior that you're not going to really stop. Having said that, most of the time, 80% of the time, they did follow the prescribed guidelines using the procalcitonin, but not all the time.
So I guess you would say that we're moving in the right direction and that a little bit more evidence-based may be helpful?
As treatments evolve and as we get better in treating patients, is to relook at some of the earlier data to find out whether the dogma that was true 10 or 15 years ago is still true today.
Okay. This brings us very nicely into our final, and this is two of them that we're going to treat together, studies, both of which appeared in the journal Science. This is taking a look at the worldwide, one of them, the emergence of resistance to antifungal drugs and how that's going to impact on both health and food security. And the other one was genomic insights into the emergence and spread of antimicrobial resistant bacterial pathogens. So interesting, whole genome sequencing has been done with a lot of these antimicrobial resistant pathogens. And so they took a look at all of that, trying to figure out, gosh, is there a way that we can be more discerning with regard to bacterial adaptation when we see that they're starting to develop resistance to the typical antibiotics? And I think this was kind of a good news thing, because taking a look at these genetic changes and how they arise and how they actually get passed from one organism to another does seem, they think, will ultimately result in the ability to extend the lifetime during which antibiotics can be useful.
They're able to take a look at healthcare-associated superbugs and antimicrobial resistance in a community-acquired infections. Because we're now such a mobile society, the antimicrobial resistance is due to something intrinsic, a mutation in a gene, translated from bug to bug. It now makes its way around the world in a much faster way. And using whole genome sequencing, we're able to track that a little bit better.
Right. Do you agree with their idea, though, that that's going to enable us to extend the utility of a lot of antibiotics?
We need to be stingy with regard to antibiotics and use them for true bacterial infections. We need to talk about rotating antibiotics and also using multiple drugs. Those are the major insights I gleaned from this particular article.
Well, let's turn from here to that other paper that we're talking about. And that's regarding the emergence of pathogenic fungi. It turns out that resistance is increasing to a lot of these antifungals.
the antifungal resistance appears to be promulgated by the use of antifungal agents in crops. Use in crops is 3 to 4 times higher than it is in humans. This has implications to the transmission of fungal disease to humans from the environment with funguses that are already resistant to antibiotics because they've been exposed to them in the field.
Clearly something where this recommendation is the same. We need to become much better and more vigilant stewards of the antifungal agents we do have.
Absolutely. Better stewards. We need to promote new antifungal discovery, and we need to leverage our emerging technology to find alternative solutions to addressing fungus in crops.
On that note, I'm going to talk about the nurse-led intervention in the ICU in New England Journal of Medicine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.